We're here because we don't buy into the bullshit of mainstream culture. We're tired of the mundane, passionless careers we've been shuffled into as a result of this orchestrated debt-based system of rule, and the stranglehold on education and entertainment by cold, soulless corporations. People, yes, we are frustrated. Yes, we are tired. And we reject the pre-approved tranquilizers that are Monday Night Football and an ice-cold Budweiser. But we have to stop hiding. Stop hiding behind the headphones and the Cherry Popper 420 username. Let the world see that the resistance is strong and society is changing. There was a time to be anonymous, but that time has passed. And so the Higher Side Chats would like to present Conspiracies as the dawning of this new paradigm in the uniform of the revolution. Because bold fashion should mean more than some celebrity meat dresser frat boy in a silly pink polo. Conspiracies redefines bold fashion as having the balls to reject socially uncomfortable and unpopular truths from your radiant chest all fucking day. Conspiracies.net. Let them know that you know. Bold designs for troubled times. Hard truths. Soft talk.
How's it going, Higher Side Chatters? Drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke. I'm Greg Carlwood, and I'm back after my first week off in 2013. Hope everyone's alive and well. The conspiracy con went awesome. We sold a lot of conspiracies, drank a lot of wine, met some awesome people, got into a capitalism argument with Foster Gamble, but hey, one of the cool people I met agreed to be my guest on the first show back to compliment a few little pieces of audio I captured at the con. So here's my chat with Olav Phillips, and afterwards, I'll have a few extra clips of random conversations from the con. So thanks, people. It's always a pleasure.
In the 1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of fire. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Higher Side Chats.
You know, folks, I'm sure we've all seen at least a couple UFO pictures or videos that really make us wonder just what the fuck we're looking at, and despite all the hoaxes and photoshops and attention-seeking dickheads that jeopardize the integrity of the UFO field with their forgeries, it only takes a couple of the good cases to bring one to the inevitable conclusion that something's up, we've been lied to, and there's a pretty distinguishable line drawn between the privileged gatekeepers and the uninformed underclass. We just don't know to what extent, and through this framework, it's really tough to mentally weave the proper proverbial basket into which one would place all these wild eggs. But today we got the basket weaver himself, whose self-proclaimed passion is serving as an archivist for the UFO and paranormal community, and he's compiled a database of over 142,000 recorded sightings. Now with 24 years of research into UFOs and the strangeness that surrounds them, he's been doing this longer than I've been pissing on my own. And the man in question is Olav Phillips, executive producer for Ground Zero Radio, frequent writer for Paranormal Magazine, and an all-around badass. Olav, my man, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Can't complain, man. Doing great. I had a good time hanging out with you and Ron Patton in our little section of the Conspiracy Con.
Yeah, paranoia. We were in the house.
What did you think of Conspiracy Con? Was the event what you expected? Did you have a good time?
You know, I've gone like five times, and you know, Brian really puts on a good show. He's always got some interesting people. But for me, one of the best parts is just talking to the people who come, because, you know, you find out a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the speakers were great. Freeman was great. Sophia Smallstorm was great. Yeah, those two are probably my favorites of the ones that I got to see, but I wish I would have seen more young people there. I mean, I realize it's pretty expensive, probably a bit out of the way for most, but I do appreciate the people that came by, said hi, gave me drugs. I would have liked to see some younger people there. You know, it seems like it's a much older audience that shows up to those type of events.
Yeah, you know, I think there are a lot of young people that are interested, but really, a lot of conventions in general, they're very expensive.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's out of reach. I think that, you know, we need to have some cheaper conferences. But, you know, it's expensive to put on. I mean, the people Brian's bringing in, you know, it's expensive to fly them in and to put them up and feed them. And so, you know, I understand, but it does put it out of the reach of most younger people.
Yeah, it's like a catch-22. You got to find a sweet spot, but I'm sure it's tough, you know. But either way, man, I mean, there's a lot of stuff I'm hoping we can talk about, much of which is in your latest paranoia article. But I really wanted to start by asking you a broader question, and that the conspiracy community, you know, is full of theories. Many of them are a bit contradictory. I mean, for example, there's people who say Kubrick helped fake the moon landing. Other people say UFOs followed them to the moon. Some people say we've discovered ancient ruins on Mars. Others say there's modern facilities on Mars. You know, some say that UFO lore is all just a cover up for secret military craft, and others say aliens are working with us in underground bases. You know, you can do this all day, but as someone who sifted through the mountains of research that you have you been able to piece together any type of overreaching narrative on the UFO alien subject?
You know, when I started out, I was like most people. You know, I started out as a kid. I saw a UFO. I saw what would typically be called the Lazar Sportster model. and at that time, you know, I was convinced, as many people are, that they were all aliens. Over time, I've kind of, the more research I do, the more I believe that they're actually mostly human in origin. You know, the Dulce thing, which is what you're referencing about them being in cahoots with the military and in underground bases. Dulce is one of the famous flashpoints where they supposedly had a war underground and there was a lot of fighting and people died. And, you know, I don't know that I believe in that stuff anymore. I think that a certain percentage of them potentially are alien in origin, maybe 5 to 10%. But I think a lot of what we're seeing today, based on the mountains of research that I've done and the books I've read and putting the pieces together, I think the vast majority of them are human.
Really? That's an interesting conclusion. I mean, well, let's talk about a couple of things in your paranoia piece. I mean, in the beginning of the article, you briefly mentioned the Serpo exchange story, which is something we haven't talked about on the show. I've heard about it before. I almost forgot about it, but and it's pretty crazy. I mean, I know there's a little bit of controversy over the sources of that information, but if it were true, it's a pretty juicy story. Can you walk us through apparently what the Serpo exchange is, and how do you feel about the story?
Well, so Serpo, basically, just to give you a broad overview, the idea behind Serpo is that there was an exchange program with aliens. And what they did is we sent, I think, 12 people. I want to say it was like 9 men and 3 women or 10 men and 2 women to an alien planet. And they lived there for a number of years. And then they came back. Most of them came back. A few of them died of natural causes or in accidents or whatever. A couple of people apparently decided to stay. Mm-hmm. But it's what happened after the end of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Close Encounters of the Third Kind supposedly is this grand conspiracy monologue of the Serpo program. And at the end, you see the astronauts going out and boarding the alien ship. Well, they're going to, but only Richard Dreyfuss ends up going. Well, in the Serpo program, they all went, and then they lived there for a long time. So that's basically Serpo in a nutshell. Me personally, you know, Serpo is one of those things where it goes away and it comes back. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like remote viewing. It goes away and it comes back. You know, every few years, people will go, well, it's a hoax, it's a hoax, it's a hoax, and then it'll go away. Then you wait another 5 years, and it'll come back. You know, it's probably dying out now. I mean, they just put out a book about it. But it'll probably die on the vine in another year. Then wait about 5 years, listen to the Higher Chat again, and you'll be talking about Serpo. Yeah. For my money, I think it's a disinformation program. I don't think that we sent astronauts to planet Serpo. I think it's a cover-up for something larger, which is Solar Warden. And that's the whole Gary McKinnon thing of what he found. Yeah.
Feel free. Go right into that. That was the next place I was going to go.
So basically, you know, Gary McKinnon hacked into some DOD, Defense Department computers because, you know, computer systems are run by human beings and sometimes, you know, they make mistakes and they leave passwords unset or passwords are simple. And, you know, in the industry, they call them script kiddies. They basically launch massive brute force hacks against servers and they run through combinations of words and letters until they get a good one, and then they can log in and mess around. And supposedly, Gary McKinnon hacked into a DOD server. He found some pretty juicy stuff about, off-world soldiers and naval people that were apparently somewhere else, and ships,
yeah,
a series of ships, logistics stuff. For my money, most of what I think he found was logistics. And, you know, logistics are one of those things where, you know, they're probably not as secure as they should be,
mm-hmm.
but it can tell you an awful lot. So the idea was that McKinnon had found these lists of people who were supposedly off-world, and then these ships that are apparently flying around in space, and then a lot of the elements about the ships, you know, what kind of stuff they were carrying and et cetera. So I think that plays into the idea of Solar Warden. Solar Warden, supposedly like a defense fleet that sits out in space and shoots down bad things. Conventionally, they say that they're shooting down aliens. I think they're actually shooting down Nazis, but we can get into that some other time.
Yeah.
And that's later in my article. But, you know, basically, I think that's what Solar Warden is that it's basically a fleet of ships. A fleet is relative. It's probably, you know, 10, 20 of them. They fly around up in space, and they have some sort of a battle, or they protect us. They shoot down asteroids, whatever.
Well, is there any evidence for Gary McKinnon's story except for, you know, his word? Was he able to print anything out? Was he able to save anything?
Oh, yeah, he saved some of it.
Really?
Yeah, but also, you know, the other thing about Gary McKinnon's story is that if he didn't find something, they're working awful hard to try to bury him.
That's true, too.
You know, and sometimes, even though you may not have multitudes of physical data and physical material to back it up, sometimes the end result of what he found and the end result of what they're trying to do to him, you know, is a litmus test to that he made somebody angry.
Yeah, I mean, I think the guy's from Scotland, and they've been trying to extradite him for, like, ever since. And I think Scotland finally said they're not going to let that happen a few years back. But, yeah, I mean, why would you go after him if you would just say, oh, he's just some crazy nut job making shit up. We don't need to mess with that. But, I mean, you know, it kind of validates what he says.
Well, they fully admit that he got in there. What they deny is what he found. Well, you know, what he found is so insane that, you know, sometimes the truth is stranger than fiction. I mean, what he found is straight up insane.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I'm here all the time.
All right. Well, so, you know, the absence of proof to me, you know, he did print some stuff out, but that absence of mountains of material that he printed out doesn't necessarily negate what he says he found.
Of course. He's
very consistent about it. He doesn't, you know, and he fears for his life.
Yeah, I mean, I think what he found is legitimate, too. I mean, it sounds completely credible, and the response from the government has kind of validates it to me. But, I mean, basically, we're talking about, like, space platforms is the term I've heard them use before. Like, these massive things that are like barges in the sky. I mean, is that kind of how you think of them?
I think there's a variety of different objects up there. I think it's like a battle barge, you know, with guns on it as probably one of them. You might think of them as like defense installations on Earth that they would be analogous to a bunker with a big cannon, you know, but I think there's also more like fast attack. I mean, my suspicion is that in space they would follow the same model they use on Earth. So you have like the bunkers and the coastal artillery,
mm-hmm.
and then you have cruisers and you have destroyers and battleships, and you know you have aircraft carriers. There wouldn't be a submarine, right? But you know, the same kind of concept.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think's powering these things? I mean, you think it's just that they're up in orbit?
Well, they're up in orbit. I think that my own take on the situation is that I think that the propulsion system is probably back engineered from German technology that was captured. Either modern or more classical German technology.
Yeah, let's get into that a little bit. There's a lot of speculation that after World War II, you know, Nazis went to a base in Antarctica and maybe even went out of the, you know, off the planet. I mean, what do you think happened at that juncture at the end of World War II?
Well, it really revolves around the Bell, right? And there are a couple of researchers that have done a lot about the Bell. There's Igor Wykowski. He was the originator of the story. Joseph Farrell latched onto it and has written a number of books about it. You know, there's Nick Cook, who wrote the Zero Point Energy book. And they all kind of discuss it. Henry Stevens has done a lot of work on it. You know, and basically what it is there's this object called the Bell, and it looks like a bell. They call it Der Glocke. And my German is bad, so you have to excuse me. I never learned German in school. But it was built at a place called Derysi in Poland. I want to say it's Poland. But they built it, they tested it, and then after the war, it disappeared along with the general who controlled the program, a guy by the name of Hans Kammler, who died, I think, 6 or 8 times. And right before the end of the war, Kammler had requisitioned these special transports. I think there were 4 or 6 of them that are the largest transports the Germans had ever built. Big, like, 6-engine transports built by Junker, and they loaded them all up and they took off. And I think if you look at that plane, it would be a pretty easy thing to go from where they were in Poland to Spain to South Africa, and then off into, you know, Argentina, and then maybe into Antarctica. And they supposedly went to a base called Base 211 in Queen Maud Land or New Schwabenland, and they had a base down there. They worked on it some more, got it perfected, and then they left.
Damn. And where do you think they went? To a space platform?
I think they probably went to Mars.
That's an interesting idea. Like, I actually, what was the guy's name? Andy Bisaggio. He talks about jump rooms to Mars and he has the Project Pegasus stuff. I went and saw one of his lectures once and I wasn't really a huge fan. It kind of turned me off from the Mars thing in general, but what makes you think that the Nazis made it to Mars? Is there a lot of anecdotal evidence for that?
There's some. I think the moon is too close. I think that probably for the last 30 or 40 years, you know, we've been piddling around on the moon. And that goes to the whole moon hoax, you know, Stanley Kubrick thing. But I think we've been on the moon for quite a number of years. In fact, I remember in the 90s, John Lear did a lecture about mining operations in the moon. And I think that we, you know, if the Nazis were going to go somewhere, the moon's kind of out because it's too close. I think Mars is the next best thing. Mars is relatively the same size as Earth, relatively the same size of gravity. You know, I mean, there's debate over what Mars's atmosphere is like. But if you're going to go somewhere, you know, it's close enough. Supposedly these UFOs that they built, the original ones could get to Mars in like a week. Now they can get to Mars in a couple of days. So, you know, it's close enough to come back and do things, but it's also far enough away that it's not necessarily a trivial exercise to go there.
Damn. Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. You think they just went there, obviously, to escape prosecution, but you think they're trying to come back? Is that why we have a space fleet out there?
I think so. I mean, look, there's a thing called the SDI program. I don't know, you know, if you're that aware of the SDI program, but in the 80s, Ronald Reagan fronted this plan to put the Strategic Defense Initiative into place. And basically what it was a lot of lasers and all kinds of crazy stuff they wanted to put in orbit. There's a thing called Project Thor, Thor's Hammer, it's like a platform. It has tungsten rods. And the idea is that you can target these tungsten rods and fire them. And they're kinetic energy weapons, and you can actually, you know, fire them in a straight line and do, you know, fairly micro targeting of specific places and things. And the the tungsten rod will survive reentry and then hit the Earth at a fairly high speed, which will create a huge crater. Well, there's also brilliant pebbles, which is basically canisters filled with marbles, like steel marbles, and it would fire and shred nuclear missiles. Then they had lasers. They even had a thing called the what was the American one? The Russian one was called the Almaz. The MOT, the manned observation, or the MOL, the manned observation laboratory, and basically it was an Air Force space station with a laser on it, and it was designed to shoot stuff down. And then the Russians did, well, the Soviets, not the Russians, but the Soviets did basically the same thing, right? They kind of matched us one for one. Their MOL was called the Almaz. It had a 20 millimeter recoilless cannon on it, and they could shoot the cannon. But, you don't put a bunch of stuff like that in orbit, for a war that's never going to come. Because we knew, and so did the Soviets at the time, through mutually assured destruction, that we were never going to start a nuclear war. I mean, you could argue in the 60s with the Cuban Missile Crisis, we came pretty close. But I don't think that the Soviet Union or NATO and the United States were particularly excited to push the button.
Right.
Because once you push the button, it's over. The minute that button's pushed, within about 45 minutes, the entire Earth is radioactive. There's nothing there, nothing left. So I don't think that, we were going to fight. So why would you put all this stuff in orbit? Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
That's a huge sacrifice to satisfy some egos.
Yeah, and I had an engineer, an aerospace engineer, call me at the end of a ground zero, and he was in Washington State. So he probably worked for Boeing, and he was saying that he worked on a Solar Warden program in the 70s, and the facility was guarded by federal marshals, and they built a constellation of three satellites, and two were parked in, they had lasers on them, and two were parked in equatorial orbit around the equator, and they just kind of circle around the equator. And then the third one was a hunter killer that it kind of was autonomous, and it would move around and shoot stuff down. You don't put that kind of stuff in orbit for a war that's never going to come. I think very early on, the Soviet Union and NATO and the United States, we recognized that we had an external threat in the Germans, and that they wanted to come back. Because, if you're going to perpetuate the Fourth Reich on Mars or wherever they went, I can't tell you concretely where they went. I know they're not here.
Right.
But if you're going to do that and you're going to leave, eventually you want to come home. You want to come back. You don't want to just set up shop out there where you have to live in dome cities or underground, or, you want to come back and you want to, perpetuate your beliefs on the Earth. So I think a lot of this stuff, they use the Cold War as a cover. There were tensions, the Soviet Union had a different perspective than we did. They do things in a very different way. They wanted the world to be a very different place than we did. And I think those tensions did exist. But again and again, we see evidence that they were talking. Khrushchev and Kennedy, some people believe that Kennedy was actually killed because Khrushchev and Kennedy were having a dialogue. And this is backed up by Khrushchev's son, that they were having a private conversation about unifying the space programs of the Soviet Union and America, and that the next mission to the moon beyond the Apollo program, should be a joint mission between the Soviets and us.
Mm.
The Soviets effectively backed down on their moon program conventionally, right? This is the stuff that anybody can go read about.
Right, right.
When they saw that we got to the moon first, they backed down because typically, on the surface of it, the Soviets were all about being the first to do something. They got the first, satellite in orbit in Sputnik. They got the first man into space, Yuri Gagarin. They got the first woman into space, Valentina Tereshkova. They got the first, animal in space, Lanka the dog. I mean, they were all about doing it first, right?
Right.
But every time they weren't the first, then they just kind of abandoned it. Like Buran. Buran was their equivalent of the space shuttle. They launched it once and went up. It was all remote control. There's nobody on board. They launched it on the Energia. They get it up in orbit. They fly it around, and they brought it back. because they weren't first. So they're like, why should we spend all this money when we're not going to, you know, reap the benefits, the propaganda benefits? But in reality, behind the scenes, you know, again and again, Kennedy was talking to Khrushchev, and other people have carried on that dialogue of having these unified space programs. And look at today, right? Today, you know, we cancel the space program effectively.
Yeah.
So we want to put somebody up in orbit. What do? We strap them onto a 30, 40-year-old rocket that the Russians are still firing off. They put them in a Soyuz capsule that they've been using since the 60s and the 70s. They take them up to a space station that we mostly built. But, you know, they had, we were sending people up to Mir originally, you know, and it's all joint. Everything's joint. In fact, our astronauts have to learn Russian. There was a big to-do about, you know, in Star City, where they launch a lot of this stuff from. In Star City, you know, the Americans had these huge palatial mansions, and they were, you know, people were siphoning off money from it, and these Russians were siphoning money from the program and building their own McMansions in the middle of nowhere at Star City. So, you know, it's all unified now. Well,
yeah.
Is it that difficult to make the leap of there's a bunch of Nazis out there that are going to fucking come and kill us? Maybe we should pool our resources to blow them out of the sky. I don't think that's that difficult of an idea to accept.
No, I think the only thing that is hard for some people is anyone who, basically people think the technology's not there. Anyone who's only keyed into the conventional. And that might be the hardest leap, is the idea that, oh yeah, the technology is there to do that. But well, I mean,
Kelly Johnson, who is head of the Skunk Works, Kelly Johnson has said publicly that, well, he said a whole series of quotes, right? But one is that he just got the contract to take E.T. home. Another one was like, we don't, you know, from the movie E.T., right? We have the technology not just to call E.T.'s home, but we can take him there. I mean, stuff like that. When Kelly Johnson, who's head of Lockheed Skunk Works, is saying things like that, I think that's significant. And I think that's something we need to pay attention to, because he's kind of letting it slip. And the thing is that we're all human, right? I mean, you can think of it in your own terms. Maybe, you know, you bought the world's greatest gift. I mean, not some mundane crap like you bought somebody a DVD that they're really going to enjoy.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, you know, yeah, my friend is a Blade Runner fan. I bought him the Blade Runner box set. That's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Right? If you bought him the Blade Runner box set with his, you know, with the outfit that Decker wore, you know, and it's signed by Ridley Scott, you know, and it's like and then he gets to have a sit down lunch with Harrison Ford to talk Blade Runner, because Harrison Ford doesn't talk Blade Runner, you know. And I mean, how do you keep that secret? Every time right. You see your friend, you'd be like, oh my God, I got you the greatest gift ever, and I got it for $5.99 on Amazon. You know, you have trouble keeping that secret. We're all human beings. And if you're not conditioned to keep the secret, keeping the secret is hard. So even people like Kelly Johnson let it out a little bit at a time. You know, and like we were talking about the bell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the military, things are compartmentalized.
Right.
And it is like that for a reason. But, you know, we were interviewing T.D. Barnes, who's an excellent aerospace engineer, a real, you know, a real patriot, a real guy that you know, did what he did for a love of his country. He worked in the Skunk Works. He worked at Area 51. He was on the Discovery Channel Area 51 documentary. He worked on the Stealth program. He worked on the A-12 program, which was a predecessor to the SR-71. And so Clyde Lewis was interviewing him and said, you know, hey, so what about the bell? Did you guys ever work on the bell? It's, you know, a lot of the conversation was not about UFOs, because
right.
T.D. Barnes is not a UFO guy. He's an aerospace engineer. He's a stealth engineer. I mean, he worked on the stealth fighter, right? And so, you know, Clyde eventually got around to him. He said, what about the bell? And Barnes like, well, I don't know what you're talking about. That's that conspiracy crap. I don't know. And Clyde said, no, it's Nazi technology. It was shaped like an acorn. Kind of described it to him, and T.D. Barnes' response was something to the effect of, well, oh, all that Nazi stuff was sent to Wright-Patterson. He's like, I know what you're talking about. All that Nazi, you know, that all that German stuff was sent to Wright-Patterson, Foreign Technology Division. Well, okay, so I guess the Bell made it to Wright-Patterson. If it made it to Wright-Patterson and made it into DARPA, then we probably have our own UFOs that are powered by it.
Yeah, not a far leap.
It's really not. You have to, you know, in conspiracy research, you have to look for the little stuff. It's these little, tiny, arcane statements because people just let them slip. It's like my gift analogy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you give somebody the greatest gift ever. You can't, you have trouble because you know it's going to bring them such joy. So you give them little hints. Well, gee, wouldn't it be great if you got a signed letter from Ridley Scott? Or wouldn't it be great, you know, if you got an insight into Blade Runner? You know, so you get these, you let out these little snippets. I mean, I do it myself. We all do.
Yeah. Yeah.
You got to look for that. That's the weakness in human nature. That's where you get the confirmation that this stuff exists. That's the Boeing engineer calling me up at the last 5 minutes of the show to tell me about this thing, and I can't ask any questions.
Man, it's a crazy story. And, you know, something else you have in that article that I thought was really interesting is this other threat, apparently, this Apophis, this asteroid that's looking like it's headed towards us in 2029. That's pretty damn scary, man. How real is that?
That's absolutely real. In fact, I suggest that everybody goes on YouTube. And Neil deGrasse Tyson did an excellent explanation of Apophis. I mean, I can't do it any better than Neil deGrasse Tyson is. I love that guy.
Yeah.
But basically, in 2029, it's going to come toward the Earth, and it's going to miss. We're not going to, you know, we're not going to flame out, you know, in 2029. But depending on its orbit, when it passes us, if it hits something called a keyhole, which is like an 8 or 9 kilometer wide, that's kilometers, kids. That's not feet. It's kilometers. If it hits inside this 8 or 9 kilometer wide portion of space, they call it the keyhole. And depending on where it is in the keyhole, depends on where it will hit off of Santa Monica. So if it's up, it hits closer. If it's down, it hits further out. And basically, it's large enough that when it hits, if it hits the Earth, it'll create a 5-mile-wide crater, 5-mile-wide, 5-mile-deep crater in the ocean. And it'll send out a tsunami at just barely subsonic speed toward the California coast.
Damn, man.
Then what'll happen is that that'll hit the coast. It'll destroy all those beautiful houses in Malibu. It'll suck all that. As the 5-mile-wide crater refills with water, it will cavitate. And so what you'll see is all the water gets sucked back in to fill that 5-mile-wide hole. So then it'll cavitate, meaning that it'll create another wave that will again hit the California, the West Coast in general. And basically, as Neil deGrasse Tyson puts it, it will sandblast the West Coast.
Well, shit. I was going to say, how far inland do you have to go? I assume you're going to be moving away from California if that's going to happen. No.
No? I've got a coastal mountain range between me and the sandblasting. I'm also, you know, over 200 feet above the water, so I think I'll be okay, but it'll be very bad. And the other thing about it is that it's going to chuck a bunch of stuff into the atmosphere, right?
Yeah.
Because it's super heated when it hits. So, you know, really the overall effect of the impact could be quite massive.
Damn, that's scary, man.
It is.
I mean, besides that, you know, let's get into something else.
I blew your mind.
Well, I mean, what do you say? It's a fucking asteroid. You can't really do much about it. And hopefully the Solar Warden people have got this on lock and they shoot that thing down.
It's a fucking asteroid that's named after the Egyptian god of death.
Right. You got to save that name for when it really counts.
That's what he points out at the beginning. You know, we didn't call it the Hello Kitty asteroid, you know?
Right.
Named it after the Egyptian god of death. I mean, that's pretty bad.
Yeah, there's some insinuations there.
But a lot of that goes back to this movie that I've been talking about a lot over the last couple of years called Alternative 3.
Yeah.
You know, really, Alternative 3 lays the groundwork for all this kind of stuff. That effectively there's something that's bad that's going to happen that's It's environmental in nature. In Alternative 3, they talk about an ice age, which is fairly feasible. And then they talk about some attempts to stop it. And there were three options to kind of stop it. One was to blow a hole in the atmosphere and vent all the carbon. This idea, we could build underground bunkers. But we couldn't build enough bunkers to save enough people. So that was deemed as not feasible. So then the third alternative was to skip town and to go to Mars. And supposedly the last couple minutes of the footage is actually footage of a man landing on Mars. So it's a joint Soviet-American man landing.
So that's interesting. This movie was put out as a mockumentary, as a farce. Apparently it was supposed to come out on April 1st, and it didn't. It came out later.
June, I think.
But how, I mean, obviously you've seen it, I haven't seen it. You feel like it was a little bit of conditioning? Was it really trying to show us something? You think it was more than just a joke?
Yeah, I do. I mean, and again, it's the absence of evidence, you know, and that's not always a great way, you know, using a negative to prove a positive. But if you look at that film, it was deemed so dangerous that they could not air it ever again. And then ITV, well, East Anglia TV that put it out, you know, the masters were destroyed in a fire. So there's no masters, there's no contracts, there's no nothing. There's only one known master to be in existence, and that's in the hands of the guy who filmed it.
Man, that's interesting.
So basically it doesn't exist.
Yeah, if it was just a joke, you would think that it wouldn't be that big of a deal to air it more than once, but well, maybe there was too much revealing information in it.
Well, so they aired it in England and Scandinavia on the same time. They simulcast it. Then they passed laws saying it couldn't be aired again. They aired it in Australia. They passed the law. They tried to air it in America. The head of NBC Drama bought the rights to it. He came back and he said, this is brilliant. You know, this will get big ratings. Standards and Practices, who are effectively the censors, said it's too dangerous for television. You know, at this point, the only country in the earth that I know of that can broadcast it is Japan. And apparently once a year they show it.
Really? Once a year? That's pretty fucking cool.
Yeah, but, you know, I think, you know, you got, like, the main astronaut who saw things on the moon. His name was Bob Grodin. You know, it's basically Buzz Aldrin. He's an alcoholic. He's been married 5 times, you know, whatever. So everybody, you know, there's an equivalency, right? That, it, you know, Buzz Aldrin is Bob Grodin, and you can kind of track down who is who. And then, you know, you look at some of the ideas they had about the nuclear missile, or the nuclear test, you know, that happened. The bunkers, you know, just read anything by Richard Sauter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you'll read all about the crazy bunker stuff they've done, the high-speed rail system under North America and all that. You know, so even to tell you why, one of the linchpins for me of why I think it's real is that, you know, a lot of times we go to these conventions or, you know, we gather amongst ourselves and people talk about chemtrails. It's like chemtrails, chemtrails, chemtrails.
Right.
Well, nobody knows exactly what they are. Nobody can really prove that chemtrails exist. It's all kind of hocus pocus. Well, the contrail takes too long to dissipate. You know, maybe it's real, maybe it's not.
Right.
But what I will tell you that is absolutely 100% certain is two things. One, when 9/11 occurred and they grounded every plane in North America, a bunch of atmospheric scientists said, oh my God, this is the first time in recorded history there are no airplanes in the air. So they all ran outside and they went and got their balloons and all their gear and they started running tests. Mm-hmm. And they proved, and there's a great documentary about this, but they proved that the ambient light on the Earth increased by like 2%, like 1% or 2%. And the temperature of the Earth started to go up. Damn. And then the second thing that happened is that in 1957, might be like 1958, Dr. Edward Teller, who is basically the father of the bomb, he fronted a plan to the American Chemical Society to dump aluminum particles in the upper atmosphere to deflect the sun and to control the temperature on the surface of the Earth. Huh. Basically, in 1958, he was the architect of what we would now call chemtrails. So if chemtrails are real, they've been at it since the 50s. It's nothing new. And these atmospheric scientists proved that whatever's going on, that something's going on. Now, some people believe that they're using chemtrails to stop a global ice age. Some people think that they're using chemtrails to control the temperature of the Earth, you know, because of the greenhouse effect. But basically, mm-hmm. chemtrails are introducing a greenhouse effect so they control the atmosphere and then they can stave off the ice age. Right. And it would be analogous if Apophis hits, if it causes a nuclear winter, something like chemtrails would be able to control that and to limit the destructive power of it.
I just have a real problem thinking that things like that are positive because there's no need to keep that such a secret. I mean, I guess you could say to keep people from mass panic, but
right. That's all the evidence you need right there, man. Because, you know, if you told everybody that let's say that alternative 3 is 100% and then we're going into an ice age, you want to tell the population of North America that like half of it is going to be covered by ice? How do you think the people in Denver, how do you think the people in you know, well, pick a spot,
right, a but in
Idaho are going to react to that? They're going to react very badly.
Right. No one wants to hear that. But if you've been doing it for years and you got it on lock and it's all under control, you know, I mean, obviously there's still a risk in telling people. You don't want everybody to go completely apeshit, but I don't know. I'm always for the truth, whether it's scary or not, you know?
Yeah. But the Brookings study in a roundabout way told us back then that we couldn't handle the truth. The Brookings study showed us that if we were 100% honest, and as my philosophy professor used to call them, Joe Sixpack, who cares about Sixpack and the 49ers,
right?
You know, if that guy found out some of the shit that's going on, you know, he would have a total mental breakdown. Now, is that 100% now? Probably not. But that is the logic that they're basing all their decisions on. You know?
And it is a fair point.
I don't agree with it, but that is what it is.
Right. Well, besides what you've written about recently and this the idea of a space war between Nazis and us, do you have any personal favorite UFO stories from your long time of research that you think might have alien origins?
Hmm. You know, there are a few. I mean, there one that I always enjoyed, you know, back in feudal Japan, there was a period of time that these golden eggs were descending from the sky and that they were landing on the beaches. And these Japanese fishermen, this is feudal Japan.
Yeah.
So this is like the 16th century, you know, that they were landing and interacting with the fishermen. You know, I find that interesting. I like a lot of the historical stuff about like the Vimanas, you know, and some of the earlier things, because they're less muddled by our own preconceptions of what this is. The mysterious dirigibles, you know, in Texas. I mean, that's kind of the stuff that I enjoy. I like the older stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there's stories that Christopher Columbus had written about lanterns that were going around the ship, under the ship, underwater.
Well, Christopher Columbus is an interesting one to talk about, because not only did he claim to see UFOs, especially when they were in the Sargasso Sea, he also claimed that there was a ghost. I want to say it was the navigator for Amerigo Vespucci that helped him, or maybe it was Magellan. I forget who the ghost was, but there was a ghost that basically helped him find North America.
Well, shit.
Yeah, well, he didn't find North America. He landed in San Salvador, but you know, Vikings found America. But that's he quote unquote found America, and a ghost helped him find it. Apparently, he's very honest about it.
Wow, I never heard the ghost aspect. That's nuts. Google is my friend. I wanted to switch gears a little bit before we wrapped this up, because I use Reddit a lot, and this week it's all about the Prism thing, this big text, phone, internet spying program. And you were telling me a bit about your IT background, and we talked a bit about built-in government backdoors at the ConCon. But have you looked into this PRISM thing at all? It's huge news this week specifically.
So really what PRISM, as near as I can tell, was all about was harvesting metadata about phone calls. So it was like who called who, from where, you know, if they were on a cell phone, which cell phone tower they utilized.
Right.
They were in their house, what are the coordinates of the house, the length of the phone call, etc. Now, the reason that that's important is that conventionally you say, well, it's important because if two terrorists are calling each other, we know where one of them is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the other guy's on a satellite phone in Afghanistan, but at least the guy in America, we know what cell tower he was working off of, right? The other thing that's interesting about it is that if you take that data and you match it to Echelon, and Echelon is that program out of Pine Gap that listens to all of our phone calls and analyzes them heuristically, that they now have the pointers of where the phone call was made. So not only do they have the context of the phone call, the actual phone call itself, they now have the points that the phone call originated and ended at. So if you take all that together, you've got everything you could ever want to know about a phone call.
Man, it seems to be a little intense. Like, obviously, they're overstepping. The thing that was really nuts to me is that the reports say that basically every major corporation is involved in just giving up data. Apple, Facebook, Google, Yahoo, Microsoft. They're just giving the NSA access to all our usage. It's kind of fucked up that no company sides is on the side of their own customers, you know?
Yeah, but you have to think about it logically, right? Is that if you look at these companies, they all have massive defense contracts.
Well, right. Yeah.
So if they don't give it up, and if they don't comply with the FISA order, you know, number one, they're legally bound to do it because FISA said it was okay. So that means that they're in contempt of court if they don't do it. But also, you know, a lot of these companies have, you know, deep, you know, Defense Department contracts. I mean, you look at Microsoft, right? Microsoft put a nice big backdoor into every Windows operating system for the FBI and the NSA, mm-hmm. Okay? Originally, when Skype, which we're talking on tonight, when Skype was developed, the engineers who built Skype, they basically used a key that was so long. And the key is that encryption key that decodes a conversation,
mm-hmm.
Right? So we both have a key, and that allows this conversation to be secure. They used the key that was so long that supposedly it would take the entire computational power of the NSA, which is significant, 75 years to crack it for every single phone call.
Wow.
Skype was sold to eBay. I don't really understand the logic of that, but whatever. I'm not at the sea level of eBay, so I don't know what they were thinking.
Right.
But, you know, eBay bought them, and then eBay really couldn't monetize it and figure out what to do with it. So they sold it to Microsoft. And what's the first thing Microsoft did? They put a backdoor in for the NSA and the FBI. There's a backdoor in Microsoft products. There's a backdoor in Apple products. Somebody introduced a few years ago, somebody introduced a rootkit or backdoor into the OpenBSD kernel path, which they took out. But, you know, you think about how big a kernel is. It's pretty complex. So, you know, there's probably somebody else, another anonymous individual probably put another rootkit in there that they haven't found. And BSD is very secure. You know, so every time there's an operating system, they put in one of these backdoors.
Man.
So, you know, you're not safe. And then there's Carnivore. I mean,
Carnivore?
This is old news. I mean, PRISM's bad because we all found out about it, you know, and maybe my cell phone's on Verizon, and, you know, now they know all about my piddly phone calls to my coworkers and to my wife. And, you know, I'm surprised and I'm shocked and I'm angry because they're spying on me. But the reality of it is that this stuff's been at work for a long time. In the 90s, they had Carnivore. Carnivore reads all your email. So they got Echelon in the 80s and the 90s, which listens to all your phone calls. They've got Carnivore, to read your email. Now this thing, now they just know, you know, physically where you were at when you made the phone call. So really, is prison bad? Sure, it's not good, but, you know, we live in a police state. Is it any worse than carnivore or echelon? Probably not.
Yeah, I mean, it really shouldn't be a surprise to anyone, but I don't know if you're much of a gamer, but the new Xbox is getting blasted by the gaming community because in the Xbox One, the Kinect camera and microphone must be connected for it to work, and it must connect to the internet at least once every 24-hour period to work. And I don't know about anybody else, but if they're cooperating with this kind of stuff, if this Prism thing is any indication of their behavior, I don't want that bullshit in my house. Why would I pay money to have that in my living room?
Well, but, you know, that's the problem with these kinds of things is that, you know, most people aren't kind of read into the situation. So, you know, you react badly to the Xbox One. I don't have one, but maybe Microsoft will give me one after this conversation. I don't know. But, you know, we're all surprised and shocked and angry. But then we have to step back for a minute and think about it logically, right? That, you know, you're shocked and upset. Maybe you're not, but you is a generic term.
Right.
Are shocked and upset because, well, the Xbox One probably has a rootkit and they could turn that camera on. Hey, I've got a Kinect. Maybe they're turning my Kinect on and listening to me at home. But what you have to go then and realize is that your cell phone can be remotely activated by Verizon or AT&T or T-Mobile or Cricket or whoever you're using. If they need to, they can turn your cell phone on without you knowing it and turn it into not only a microphone but a video camera. They've rootkitted your computer, so if they really wanted to, they could turn on my camera right now and they could see me and turn on my mic and they could see me as well. These things are already in the wild. I mean, the idea behind the Xbox One, they're just late entrance to the police state. Your cell phone right now. I don't know who your carrier is, but it doesn't matter. Right. Whoever your carrier is can switch your cell phone on right now and listen to this conversation, and you'll never even know.
Man, you hear it, and I mean, I don't know if I've known of any cases of anyone being, you know, if it coming forth, they were prosecuted because their cell phone was turned on. But yeah, it's scary shit. It just sucks. You know, all the major corporations are aligned against us, and that's no secret. But, you know, we're their customers, and people keep giving them their money and allowing them to be so powerful. Of course, you know, government contracts are helping too, which is also our money. I don't know if you heard the story about the UPS FedEx thing, but the government agencies were approaching all these major shipping companies, wanted to sift through them, looking for people mailing pharmaceuticals, apparently. And UPS was like, yeah, guys, no problem. Take whatever you need. And then FedEx rejected the notion, and the CEO released a statement somewhere in the ballpark of, we have no interest in violating the privacy of our customers just to verify if a package contents are legal, which was awesome. You know, I rarely see that coming from a company. I mean, that's why take the headache of coming out and saying, oh yeah, we're just gonna defy the government. But I mean, hey, if you gotta mail drugs, use FedEx.
If you want to ship guns or drugs, use FedEx. But you know, the thing about it is that they say that now, but if they got a knock on the door from the FBI or the BATF, they'd hand it over in a heartbeat.
Right. It doesn't take much.
No, they're doing it now because they have an out. But if that out disappears and they've got a FISA order that says that they have to do it, they'll do it.
Right.
Because there's really no alternative, right? If you fight the FISA order, the only thing that's going to happen is you're going to end up in a federal maximum security, you know, prison.
Yeah.
They'll probably label you as a known combatant and send you to Guantanamo.
Right. I mean, it is a bit overwhelming, man, you know?
The thing that bothers me more than the surveillance, because we live in a surveillance society. Mm-hmm. And I remember I lived in England and they had this truck and they would park it in front of the pubs. And the truck was basically literally had just 360 degrees of CCD cameras, and they didn't even cover it up. They just parked the surveillance van and they could see everything and they could hear everything. In every country, we live in a surveillance society. It's just what happened. What bothers me more is what's coming out of the Department of Justice, where they're saying that, well, we can classify you as an enemy combatant and we can kill you from orbit. which they can do, or we can kill you with a drone in America because we don't like you. Well, that to me is the bridge. That truly bothers me. The idea that they can listen to my cell phone, I can't control it, so I just ignore it because you can't stop it. But the drone right. thing, that's
it's another level.
That's terrifying.
Yeah, man. Well, that just about does it. We've talked about so many enlightening and positive topics, from Nazis' bases on Mars attacking us, and Apophis, sure. the giant space rocket doom, spy satellites. It's been a very uplifting and positive talk, man. I really do
appreciate
it. I'm the
happy man.
Yeah. Well, is there anything you want to tell people about before we let you go? I mean, I know the next time I'm going to see you again is going to be at the Paranoia Con, which is taking place here in sunny Sandy, Comic-Con weekend, July 19th through the 21st, I think. I actually want to say that Ron Patton is an awesome guy. I just got to meet him at the Con. This is his first time throwing an event like this. I think he has some really great speakers, yourself, Adam Gorightly, Andy Coven, a bunch more. THC fans should definitely come out. But, I mean, what are you going to be talking about? The same kind of thing, the Nazi space bases?
Well, you know, I'm going for something truly uplifting. I want to talk about just the happiest stuff on Earth, and so yes, I'm talking about Nazi space bases and the coming apocalypse. I wanted to aim high and, you know, leave satisfied, happy customers.
Of course, with rose-colored glasses.
Right. Take the pill before you show up.
I always do, but
you know. The thing I wanted to pop in there at the last minute is, you know, we were talking about how expensive these cons can be and about how people can't afford it, you know, and Ron is a pretty cool guy, and he looked and searched for a place that we could hold it that would be cost effective. So your ticket's $20, you know, $20 right. bucks a day, $50 for all 3 days. You know, come on out. It's cheap. You can afford it probably. And if you can't, you come to the door and you don't quite have $20, you have $15 or something, and you know it's legitimate. Let us know, and we'll make something happen.
Yeah, we're gonna check your pockets, but
yeah, we'll turn you upside down.
No, that's a great point. It is pretty damn cheap, and I think the speakers are awesome. I'm excited to hear you talk. I'm excited to hear Adam talk. We had Andy Coven on the show a while ago talking about the Mothman and some fascinating stuff about Union Carbide and some really deep level stuff. He was a great guest too, so I'm sure he's going to talk about some interesting topics. You know, so after you've seen the new Spider-Man trailer that you can also just watch on YouTube, maybe you should come out and hear some real shit down the street.
There you go.
But is there anything else you want to tell people about? Your website, your Roku channel?
My Roku channel is theanomalieschannel.com. You can add it there. It's free. I don't charge. A lot of the stuff that I write, you can find on conspiracyhq.com or paranoiamagazine.com. And if you want to find out more about paranoia, the Paranoia Con, etc., paranoiamagazine.com.
Awesome. There it is. Well, thanks a lot, man. You're an awesome guy. It's been lots of fun. I'm psyched to see you again. It's been a great time talking to you.
Yeah.
Have a good one.
You too.
All right, man. All right, people. That was Olav Phillips. It is great to be back. Thanks so much for listening. Tell your friends. Share the show. Give me a thumbs up on Stitcher, a 5-star wherever you are. These are the currencies of the digital world. Here's some random chats from the Con, and I'll see you guys next week with Rupert Fucking Sheldrake. Peace.
To a core, it comes down to a ranch in Dragoon, Arizona. Now, Dragoon is a pretty unique name. Merlin, the magician, he only had one magic word in his arsenal. That word was Dragoon. And that revolves around this ranch. It's called the Triangle T Guest Ranch, which I'm in the works of assembling the money and the spirit to get to buy that. The people who own it now are very well aware that I am the repurchaser of that property. It's a place where the Kennedys and the Rockefellers and the Vanderbilts and Walt Disney, people from NASA, went there. In my understanding, I don't quote me on this, but in my understanding, it was to have meetings with the Ark of the Covenant to see how to build our current dream, our infrastructure, and our influence.
Something beyond what we have right now.
Well, they got that to build what we're in right now. Gotcha. So my project is to buy this ranch and to buy it as a republic and to institute paperwork called corpus separatum, which is what Jerusalem is trying to accomplish in the Middle East right now. Well, there's a little bit of dysfunction in that whole story because we live in a place called America that is, really revolves around New Jerusalem, which is what we're looking for. We have to go back a little bit, but it's about moving forward. So this New Jerusalem will be at a place in Arizona that starts with a ranch. It starts with a certain community, and I have the maps, and I'm going to reveal that on the 4th of July and everything to the public, that the authorities that we want this to happen. And it's a really beautiful story of just the creating of stories. That's why we're going through this mess. Everyone wants to know why. Well, we have an infinite amount of entertainment just from the past that we can be entertained from the future. So we can go through the future not making mistakes, not creating funny stories, because we can spend eternity laughing at ourselves from the things we did in the past. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely does. You know, things have been messed up for quite some time. It's odd. You alluded to the fact that the people in charge want this progression to happen. They're not in opposition to this now.
Absolutely not.
So I think that's what would throw people the most, is that they think that that's who we're fighting against, and you're talking about them actually wanting to facilitate or help in this transition.
Right. It's the middlemen that is really the dysfunction at this point. I'm not saying we don't need anything in the middle of anything. We need everything. It's just a time of shifting right now. It's very easy for us. All right. The people in Congress, all right, the president, very tough jobs, right? We all see them as people with a lot of power, but we also see something behind them that is a power over them.
Absolutely.
So what we're trying to connect is to those two things. We can create a forum, and we're going to practice this experiment with the land that provides itself and the people, yes, to come to. It's hard for me. I really don't want to reveal too much because I don't want to interfere with people's lives and the way they stand, because it is going to be a project that everyone agrees with.
Absolutely.
It's not going to be by surprise. It's just...
When do you think knowledge of this is going to hit a mainstream level?
On the 4th of July, this should be headline.
Across mainstream media?
Absolutely, 100%. Not me. I think mainstream media is going to be unable to avoid. They can't avoid it. So
okay. And it's going to be known as Project 45?
Yes, Project 45, the United States of Mind.
United States of Mind. And what, on the 4th of July... What sort of changes? Is that when some changes will start to get made? Is it all about this place in Arizona? Will there be any changes to government?
On the 4th of July? Okay, yes. Why? Because you're the government. Because whoever sees this project and sees the information and sees my story, their minds will be instantly transformed. And so you're the government. People who are unaware of these truths are the government. So yes, immediately, anyone who sees the information that I have to present, immediately, yes, there is a change in the government because they are the government.
Well said.
It seems like abstract thinking, but it's really simple when you get down to it. And a lot of people have lost their concept with they are the government. Everything was for a time and a place. There's ultimately no judgment in any of this. You know, the great day of judgment is about no judgment. It's about using us a day when finally everyone on earth, everyone is in their right mind. Everyone is in their right state of mind, and we're a united state of mind. And we're in a place one day, the day of judgment, where we can all have a place of peace for 1 second, 1 minute, 1 hour, just sitting down, holding hands. Corny little story of a united humanity. I believe in it. My life's work has no room for failure because I work for God. I work for the American people. I work for every living sentient being in the universe because I dedicated my life to that. I'm not going to stop until there's no one left to help. Essentially, all I have to do is help myself and allow that to unfold. So it all comes down to that. I'm not trying to change anyone. I'm not trying to fix anything. I'm not trying to do anything. I'm just trying to be me. And I'm trying to be the best me that I possibly can.
Well said, Jeremiah. And the website is Project 45?
I'm not sure about the details. I'm sure that will be set up at a time. It's a very organic experiment. And so I have a Facebook page set up right now that is called Project 45, the United States of Mind. I don't have much load onto it, but I think that in the next couple of days I'll have a lot of pictures uploaded that will open the door for an intense amount of questions.
Awesome. Well, thanks for talking to us, Jeremiah. It's been a pleasure.
Awesome. Thanks.
That was us talking with Jeremiah Kaler of Project 45.
Where is my mind? Where is my mind? Where is my mind?
How's it going, Higher Side Chatters? I'm here with Peter Dorsett. We're sitting here talking at the Conspiraties booth at Comic-Con 2013. Peter knows a lot about law, and he also knows a lot about UFOs. He's been schooling me for a little while now. Peter, how's it going?
I'm doing good, Greg. Thanks for asking.
What can you tell us about law that has been kind of kept from us that people might not have been educated about that would be pretty helpful for them to know?
Well, the interesting thing, when I taught law for about 15 years in Sacramento, I became a paralegal, and I boiled down something that was very elementary. I said, do you know the difference between something that's lawful and something that's legal? And most people said, well, they're the same, aren't they? And I said, no, actually, if you look them up in a law dictionary, you'll notice that there's more than one definition. However, let me boil it down for you so you have a conceptual idea of what lawful is as opposed to what legal is, since that's the basis of what we're going to talk about. Lawful is something that's done of, by, and for the people with their permission and consent and approval. Legal is something that's done behind closed doors by attorneys, congresspeople, for the sole purpose of extracting funds from somebody. So when somebody says, oh, that's illegal, I tend to look up in the sky looking for a sick bird, an illegal. There are many languages that as Americans, we have the ability to think in. We are street language, which is what most people converse in. There's the written language, which is more formal. Then there's legalese, and legalese has a different meaning than what a lot of people think. And so there's rules and guidelines called law dictionaries. For example, Black's Law Dictionary. The first edition came out in 1890. They are now up to edition number 10. The interesting thing that's difference between, say, Webster's Dictionary and a law dictionary is that Webster's Dictionary is used, common usage dictates what the word means. And that can change over time. Let's take, for example, a word that most people are now familiar with as gay. That now means someone who's homosexual. However, you look at a dictionary from, say, the 1950s, gay meant someone who was happy. So by common usage, that word changed. Once you understand that, the difference between, say, Webster's Dictionary now, the definition in Black's Law Dictionary, there's a number of other publications that are also called law dictionaries, but the Black's Law Dictionary is the most popular, and that's what's used in the court system. And what they do is they change the language to change your perception. Here's an example. Starting with the edition number 7, which came out in 1992, up through now, the word United States as a definition was eliminated from Black's Law Dictionary. The word that was substituted was United Nations.
Really? That's a little creepy.
Yeah. Well, that gets you to start thinking. The other thing is, if you look at the back of Black's Law Dictionary, you'll see that it's published by the British. So the British actually are still in control of the law in this country. The other thing that you'll note when you get into studying, say, for example, the United States Constitution, which is a very short document in which all of the laws and rules of this country are governed by. So you have laws, regulations, statutes, and codes. One of the things that I try to tell people is, what is the definition of code? Do you know, have you ever heard of what the definition of code is? And they'll say, well, no. And I said, okay, look it up in Webster's Dictionary to start with. You'll learn, and here's something that I say. Have you ever heard the movie Wind Walkers? Starred Nicolas Cage. He was dealing with some Navajo Indians who were able to speak in the clear because they were using code. Code, when you look it up in Webster's Dictionary, means secret language. So why do you suppose they call it the IRS code or the DMV code?
The penal code.
In the penal code, it all means you have to have a code book to decode it. So it's secret language. So we're being duped. So there's your beginning of law.
Hey, that's great information. I mean, it makes total sense. It's also interesting because it seems like if you want to see the direction in which the country's going, look at the legal, what they put on paper, because a lot of times that stuff, they'll put it on paper and then it doesn't roll out for a few years and then it becomes common.
Well, let me expand a little bit on that, Greg. You have in this country, if you go back to the beginning, this country broke away as 13 colonies in a war that started in 1776. That was the beginning. It didn't end in 1776. It started in 1776 and ended in 1781. We defeated the British. Greg, I'm going to ask you a question. What happened to the British at the end of that war? What did they do?
Well, we're told they went home.
They went home with their weapons in tow. Does a vanquished foe leave with their weapons from the battlefield?
No, they'd be lucky to leave with their heads.
That's right, exactly. So what's wrong with this picture? In that, a lot of people don't know that. Now, let's fast forward to the next war that we had. And that was called the War of 1812, which lasted for 3 years till 1815. And then there was another war that started in 1861 and ended in April of 1865. And that one is often referred to as the American Civil War. Now, let me ask you a real important question, because this is going to lead into the other things, which a lot of people want. Where's the UFO stuff, right? Okay. So what do you suppose those three wars were all about? They're all about the same thing, but what do you think they were all about?
Well, we're told power and territory.
No. It was about creating a central bank.
Well, yeah, that's true. The underlying, the subtext that isn't taught in schools, that seems to be very prominent in the conspiracy world, is that, yes, all war is basically about the monetary system in which the people are going to operate under.
Exactly. But you see, what happens is that we tend to forget that which is written or whatever. And so we speak in terms of generations. Each generation is about 25 years. So we asked somebody, I was in the Vietnam War in the 60s, and I asked someone that may be 40 years younger than me, maybe two generations younger than me, and I'll say, what do you know about the Vietnam War? And they'll say, not much. It's pretty much a forgotten war, much like Korea. Well, I grew up during the Korean War. I was born right at the end of World War II, but I studied those because it was important to me. The average person doesn't, because it's in their mind, it takes up too much time. So when you look at what's important to you, you become involved with it if it means something to you. So we can fast forward into the UFO stuff at any time, but let me give you one more idea behind these things that you were talking about with the drones. In our country, we have three bodies. One is called the legislative, which supposedly creates the law. We have the executive, which is the enforcement arm. And then we have the judicial, which is the interpretation. Well, what most people don't know is that we're governed by executive orders, which are written by the president. This, when you do the research, started in 1861 with Abraham Lincoln. And the executive orders, if you go in and look at the congressional records, they were basically promotions and demotions of federal people, employees. Not until you get to 1933 do you really understand that it had to do with banking, because on March 9th, 1933, Franklin Delano Roosevelt placed this country into bankruptcy, and they've been in bankruptcy ever since. And it's sort of interesting when you look at a Federal Reserve note, you ask someone, what is this? They don't know. But a note is a promise to pay. It's an IOU. So how do you discharge a debt with another debt instrument?
It's a tricky question.
It is. And yet most people can't answer it, because they don't have enough factual background information to even go there. So what you were alluding to with the drones and everything else is the, quote, imperial arm of the executive branch doing whatever they want.
Absolutely. And there are some speakers, there are some people out there that are talking about the idea that the UFO story was all a cover-up to cover up the drone technology. Would you subscribe to that, or do you think there's real UFOs? You've been telling me about that.
Yes, UFOs do exist. They've existed for a long time. If you look at ancient history, there's a lot of pictographs, a lot of monuments. There's obviously the pyramids, things like this. Puma Punku down in Bolivia. You know, you got stones that are 400 or 500 tons. It can't be moved by any modern equipment to this day. There's no trees, so they didn't move them with trees. How did they do it? And the naysayers will say, oh, it was just, you know, it just happened that way. They don't have enough. They have what is known as cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance means, well, I've never heard that, so I can't believe it. And there's a lot of that going on with UFOs. UFOs and the UFO people, the UFO community, we've been visited by people from our own future. And there's a number of people that have subscribed to that, that are aware of that, that know we are being visited right now by people from our future. They have cloaking capabilities. They have the ability to shapeshift. They have all these abilities, and yet when we don't understand it, we say, I can't believe it, so therefore I don't believe it.
What do you think is the best evidence that a skeptic or someone who wants to believe but is looking for that smoking gun, what do you think is the best thing they could look at in terms of the UFO story?
Well, whenever you come across any kind of knowledge that you don't know about, whether it's law or anything else, you have to look at it from many different angles. One of the things when I was teaching law was when you get a citation, it's because someone cited you. It was a visual. That's where citing, although it's spelled S-I-G-H-T-I-N-G, the citation is spelled C-I-T-A-T-I-O-N. So, but it means the same thing. It means there was visual evidence. What happens is when we're doing a lot of research is we tend to hear information. In a court of law, that becomes known as hearsay evidence. So when you're doing UFO research, you're going to hear a lot of hearsay evidence. Until a person actually has their own encounter and they see with their own eyes, one of the things that I learned in my study of this is that we actually have two eyelids. We have an outer eyelid and an inner eyelid. And one of the things that a person can do with this is they can learn how to control energy, and that is by looking at the sun. And if they open up the inner eyelid, they can allow themselves to look at the sun. When you look at the sun, you're receiving energy that was around and has been around a long time. The ancients knew this. I mean, you ask the questions, how many ancient people did you know wore glasses? They didn't. They didn't need them.
It's a very controversial subject, but I've seen the documentary Eating the Sun, which is kind of what we're talking about. There are people who get their nourishment and their energy from staring at the sun. It seems incredibly controversial because that's the doctrine of how dangerous that is has been drilled into our heads since childhood. And it seems like it would be dangerous. It hurts. It hurts my eyes to look at the sun. Of course, in the movie, they talk about different techniques. You look at it at the when it's low in the horizon or during the rise or the setting. But that's really interesting. You've had some positive experiences and some real results from sun gazing?
Yes, I have. And I did find that on the internet. It's actually called Eat the Sun. So just go to Google, type in Eat the Sun. There's something else you can do while we're kind of on that subject is type in Google the secret life of plants, and you'll learn about how plants are sentient. You can also type in Dr. Emoto's water research, and you learn that water, or any liquid for that matter, is sentient. And the crystalline structure of that can change just by the mere thought, not just the words spoken, but the mere thought of that can change the crystalline structure. So ultimately, what does that mean? Going back to your original question, it has to do with how we believe. If we don't believe there's UFOs or if there's aliens or anything, we'll never believe it because our mind has put up a blockage for us and we can't see that. Once the veil is lifted, I mean, I could take you out to places where a group of us will watch UFOs and somebody that doesn't believe in UFOs can't see them. Really? And everybody else can see them and look at them. Yeah, well, there's lots of them. But they can't see them because their mind's eye doesn't allow them to see it. They're saying no.
And how does that work with video evidence?
Well, video captures what it sees in terms of light capturing. Our ability with our lens and our eyes and our iris is that we do an interpretation in our brain. So if you actually look at, when we look at something that's written, it's actually backwards. It goes through this process in our mind and we have to flip it. And there are people that have retinosis and a number of other diseases that can't do that. They don't have the ability to switch that. So they have to learn how to see things upside down backwards. And to them, that's right. It's like, how do you define colors to someone that's never seen colors?
Right.
I mean, that's something that we take for granted, and that's in the UFO community. Those of us that are in the know, we sort of take it for granted that there's a lot of people that don't know. that how did they get aware of it? And the answer is really, you ask someone, when did you first have your first experience, or how do you know? I taught a training, and when I was teaching real estate, we called it mastery. And the question was, how do you know? And the answer ultimately is, you want to boil everything down into as few words as you can. The answer is, you know that you know when you know that there's no other answer. You've come up with, it can't be anything else. And so you come to that conclusion, whether it's by deduction, reasoning, or whatever else you may want to call it, that you know, and you have an intuition about whether, and some people call it a sixth sense. So it's, in some regards, it's like knowing, if I told you, Greg, that there is shapeshifters among us, I can see them, you can't, you'd say, how do you know? And I said, because I can see them. There's been movies that have been alluded to that some people wear special glasses, and they live, and they can see that. Well, that's what happens for those of us that can see the law, for example, or how it's being subverted, is that our country is being taken over, and has been for a long time. It's a corporation, and that's another subject. But when you get into this thing of knowledge, it's like, how much do you want? It's like, how much of the pie do you want to eat? How much of the knowledge do you want? You want just a little taste, or do you want to know more? And it's insatiable. For me, it's insatiable, meaning that one thing leads to another. So law can lead to UFOs, can lead to new discoveries that most people say that can't happen. I mean, we have technology now that can make a person invisible. We also have technologies that you can point a weapon and disintegrate somebody, totally vaporize them. I mean, that sounds like DC comic stuff, but in reality it exists. I know, I was in the military. I had above top secret clearance. I was an infantry commander, and then I was a public information officer. So I have the knowledge of firsthand being able to experience it, see it, feel it, touch it, everything else. When you talk to someone, you must qualify them by asking who, what, why, where, when, and how. What is your experience? How did you come about it? How do you know that exists? A lot of people like to give lip service to something because they want the recognition. And when I asked you originally what our most basic needs are, the answer should be air, then water, then food, then shelter, and then love. Well, what has happened for a lot of young people is they've taken love as the number one requirement in the form of texting, because they can be instantly recognized, oh, I'm great, oh, I'm wonderful, or whatever. And they don't realize that they're giving up or sacrificing their personal freedoms. Yeah.
I thought that was a really good point you made before we started recording, that a lot of people are getting their validation from status updates and having that phone on them all the time and the social media aspect, because there is a deficiency in the love area, and it's like a crying out for attention. And I see that so often, you know, just telling people, hey, I'm eating a sandwich today, you know, and everybody should know that. And it's really like, you know, you don't really have anything to say, but you're crying out for some type of attention, some type of validation, because everybody is too busy to really love each other. Everybody's on their own. I'd say capitalism puts us in a situation where it's every man for themselves, makes it hard to work in teams that are going to last a long time. But, yeah, I think there's definitely a love deficiency. I think that's what, Foster Gamble talks about with the Thrive Movement. He's here today. I thought that was a great point. That deficiency is being made up with the technology.
I would agree with you, Greg. And when you think about, here's a question that you can ask your listeners. And this should be a question that when you meet a stranger, you should not be afraid to ask. So what major contribution have you made to society? You think about it. That's a real deep question. Because in some regards, people would say, why are you asking me that? Well, the answer is, what value do you see in what you've done? How are you contributing to make this a better place? Instead of just taking, which most people are, they're takers, there's very few givers.
Or they're contributing only to the success of one corporation or one entity that isn't really doing anything, or in most cases working against the interests of the society as a whole.
What they do is they trade their labor for money, and money is driving people in most respects. In fact, one of the courses that I taught was called Mastery, and one of the questions that we would ask is, what is your purpose? A lot of people say, do I have to have a purpose? No, you don't have to have a purpose, but the people that can define their purpose clearly and succinctly in, say, two sentences and can repeat it over and over the same thing, they're on focus. My purpose, and has been for many years, is to help and educate people so that they become empowered, so they can teach other people through their own life's experiences, how to resolve problems or challenges.
That's a worthy goal, and it's good that you found your path. I appreciate talking with you, Peter. It's been awesome. The listeners, I'm sure, enjoyed it. Do you have a website? Is there some place people can check out your work?
I did, but I had it hacked, so it's down now. I do have an email address. You want me to give me?
Absolutely.
It's Peter, P-E-T-E-R, at the, G-H-E, info, I-N-F-O, wizard, W-I-Z-A-R-D, .net. Peter at theinfowizard.net.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, man. Enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you, Greg.
Where is my mind? Where is my mind? Where is my mind?
What's happening, people? I'm here at the ConspiracyCon 2013, standing at the booth for Programming the Nation. Pretty awesome movie about subliminal images in the media and commercials and whatnot. I'm here with the writer, producer, and director of that movie, Jeff Warrick, and he's going to tell us a little bit about it. Jeff, how's it going, man?
Hey, good, Greg. How you doing?
Can't complain. So what's the main message behind this movie, Programming the Nation?
Well, the main message is that, you know, we're controlled in a lot of ways that we're completely unaware of. Media has a very pervasive effect on all of society, and so the goal is to control and keep people in line and dumbed down and you know, uninformed and misinformed, and the film kind of covers a lot of those things and how it happens. For me, making the film was really kind of a 9/11, I guess, was a catalyst for it. After 9/11, I started becoming curious as to a lot of things, you know, what happened on that day and with that event specifically. But also, I started looking at media in new ways. I started looking at how the media was beating the drum for war in Iraq, and you know, how they were kind of juxtaposing images of Saddam Hussein and 9/11 when you know, Saddam was never involved with terrorism, 9/11, and that they never ever found weapons of mass destruction there. So things like that kind of, I looked at the media and why they were doing that, and, you know, I knew that the war was going to be inevitable. And so since then, all we've been doing is fighting this long war on terror, which is just a ploy to keep people afraid. And in line, and so the film kind of takes a look at a lot of these things. I try to it uses subliminal messaging as kind of the narrative thread that pieces it all together. But we talk about things like Project HAARP in Alaska, psychological operations that our military industrial complex is using and has used here at home, similar to things like Project MK Ultra in the 60s and 70s. Now they have much more sophisticated ways of you know, programming the population and also, you know, as weaponry too, when you think about it, and what they can do without even having to shoot a bullet or launch a bomb or a missile or anything. So
absolutely, man. I mean, I've seen the trailer here. It's got a high production value. It's pretty awesome going through some of the commercials and stuff, seeing the sex written in the ice. And, you know, the marketers aren't doing that for no reason. You know, there's obviously something in our brains that is taking that in that we're not aware of. And it's pretty cool to see all the examples lined up like you have in the movie. The production quality is great. Are you planning any follow-up to this one?
In terms of a follow-up, I mean, I'm not really engaged in any current projects, but we are looking at doing a second film on this. And, you know, what's funny is after finishing the film, I kind of realized how, you know, what we cover in the film is really just the tip of the iceberg, how there's so much more going on. There's things like, you know, government harassment and eavesdropping that is becoming more and more prevalent, particularly with people that are truth seekers, as well as the free press. You know, they don't want the press to be free. So they want to monitor them. They want to follow them. They want to harass them. And they use a lot of high-tech means to do that. So
absolutely, man. That's awesome. And so just tell the people, where is the movie available online for free?
Yeah, it's available at programmingthenation.com, which is our website. So you can go there and check it out. And there's a Play Now button, and you can watch the movie online.
Awesome, man. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Where is my mind? Where is my mind? Where is my mind?
What's up, folks? We're still here at the Conspiracy Con on the final few hours. I'm here with the man, Big Daddy, Ron Patton. He's the guy from Paranoia, the publisher of Paranoia Magazine. Ron, how's it going?
It's going quite well, Greg. How are you?
I can't complain, man. It's been fun being neighbors with you through this event. How do you think this one stacks up compared to previous Conspiracy Cons?
Well, it's been pretty good for the most part. I mean, it's a different venue. We were meeting at the Santa Clara Marriott since the beginnings, I think since 2000. So, you know, it was a bit of an adjustment as far as how the tables were set up. But I think the crowd was still very enthusiastic, and I happened to be able to sell quite a few books and magazines, so I think it went well for me in that respect.
Right, that's the reason why we're here, primarily, is to pay the bills. But it's a bit of a trek for me, and it's awesome that in a couple of months you're going to have an event a little closer to home. We're both from San Diego. In conjunction with Comic-Con, you're going to have the Paranoia-Con, where our buddy Adam GoReilly is going to be speaking, as well as a couple other people. What else is going on there?
Well, it's going to be held July 19th, 20th, and 21st, and it's going to be very reasonably priced, $20 a day. Or $50 for 3 days, so you really can't beat that as far as the price is concerned. But the quality of speakers, I think, are exceptional. We're going to have John Judge, who's a prolific writer about political assassinations. And then, of course, like Greg mentioned before, Adam GoReilly, who's going to be the upcoming radio host for Paranoia Magazine Radio. And he's a very prolific writer for Paranoia as well. And he's written several really great books. And then we're going to have Ken Thomas, who's a conspiracy icon, former publisher of Steam Shovel Press. And then we just have a new addition, actually, Dr. Lauren Murray, who's going to be talking about Fukushima and the effects that it's had, not just in the United States, but worldwide. And I think that's going to be extremely intriguing. And Andy Colvin will also be there, the Mothman, known as the Mothman photographer and researcher of anomalous creatures. And then Cynthia Hamill, who's from San Diego, she's going to be talking about electronic harassment and organized gang stalking. And then a good friend of mine, Marie D. Jones, will be discussing time travel and sort of separating the fiction from the fact. Nice. So that's just a few speakers that we're going to be having. And again, that's July 19th, 20th, and 21st. And you can check periodically at www.paranoiacon.com for updated information.
Right on, Ron. Well, all right, people. We're going to get back to the tables, have a couple more beers, try to get through the rest of this day, and take the long trek back to sunny Sandy. All right, man. Thanks for talking to me.
Hey, it's a pleasure, Greg.
All right. We'll see you next month. Peace.